That's brilliant. Today, we're coming to the end of our series on looking at issues around the vote that's coming up on Thursday. I hope we're all going to vote, even if you think I don't want to encourage any of them. In fact, I heard the monster raving loony guy has said he will donate to charity as he gets votes. So if you want to go, I don't want to encourage anybody, at least go and vote to donate to charity. But we're looking at some serious issues, of course, and we've looked at economics, we've looked at the ecology, and we've looked at migration, which does not start with an E, which is a real problem. We did look at ethnicity, actually. And today we're looking at ethical issues. If you were to talk about ethical issues, what do you think would be one of the ones that you would want to hone down on? Just think about that for a moment. What are the ethical issues out there? And while you're thinking about that, we'll read from Genesis. Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 to 31. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful, increase in number." You know, that's the only real command that we've kept fully, okay? God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said to them, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And all the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." And so it was. And God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Verses 26 and 27 are the foundation of one of the most important ideas in Christianity, that we are made in the image of God. Each of us is made in the image of God. Each one. Each of you reflect something of the living God. Bear something of the living God. And how precious is that? That makes each person precious. It's not the skills that we have. It's not the looks that we have. It's not the ability to kick a football. It's not our intelligence. It is that we reflect, we hold, we bear the image, the likeness of the living God. One of my students is writing a dissertation on the church and people with profound learning difficulties, people whose educational problems are indeed profound, and she's looking at how do we all, even those with very, very limited abilities, hold, bear witness to our Creator God? And this is the foundation to many ethical considerations. I found a website called, and I'm useless at pronouncing Latin. Coming from New Zealand, I didn't even know that Latin was a country. But the image of Imago Dei, the image of God. Our challenge is to see the image of God in the suffering, the marginalized, the oppressed, and the hurting. Our challenge is to see the image of God in those that the world devalues, the handicapped, the imprisoned, the stigmatized. Our challenge is to see the image of God in every human being, including those with whom we disagree. Our challenge is to see the image of God in those who oppose us, even those that persecute us and slander us. Our challenge is to see the image of God in friend and foe, acquaintance and stranger, strong and weak, oppressor and liberator. Our challenge is to see the image of God in ourselves and in each other. Our challenge is to see the image of God. And with that challenge before us, coming back to that question, hopefully we've had time to sort of, I hate asking questions straight off the bat, but what are some of the ethical issues out there?
Injustice within society,
yes.
But the gap between the rich and the poor should grow as slowly as
possible. Indeed shrink, yes. The gap between the rich and the poor. Injustice issues, and I mean, if you were to get involved with the asylum seeking association down in Barton Street, you would begin to see levels of injustice we just did not know exist. What else is out there? What else is happening? What's current?
Child trafficking,
very much. Yeah.
The world of finance, we have standards.
The standards within finance looking at the banking system, etc., etc. Yeah? Yeah, very much so. Sharon posted about one the other night, the issue of assisted suicide. There is a bill going through Scotland Parliament right at the moment. That's been presented before and not gone ahead. It's been presented again, not gone ahead. It's now being presented again. Lord Falconer's bill has been presented to Westminster Parliament twice, I think, and it will come back. It will be re-presented. And I've chosen today to concentrate on that one issue. Because it's a good model, we can develop a model for how to think ethically. Now, I don't want to abuse the pulpit. You may come out of here going, actually, I disagree with you, Colin. That's fine. I am actually fairly passionate about this. But I also understand that I'm not speaking that you have to agree with me. But I would like to present, this is a mode of working things through, that we have to take certain things into consideration to reach the end point we're at. So assisted dying is a very good issue to tackle, to look at how do we tackle these things. It is a current one. And it is one, if it goes through, could actually profoundly affect society. We need to be clear what we're talking about here. Assisted dying, assisted suicide, is the proactive intervention to deliberately cause the end of someone's life. Someone who is terminally ill. It's deliberately ending a person with terminal illness's life who is asking for it and may not be able to do it themselves. This bill, of course, sits in a much wider conversation about euthanasia and places like Dignitas in Switzerland, etc. We're not looking at that full breadth. We're just going to look at the nature of assisted suicide. Now, it's also important to realize what we're not talking about. We're not talking about opposing or placing other options rather than aggressive treatment. Some people go, medical, we can do so much, and that's leading to all sorts of problems. Yes, that's true. To look at options that are not about aggressive treatment is fine. It's okay to think through perhaps I won't face this chemotherapy because the odds are just so not there. I would do it in a different way. That's not what we're talking about here today. That's a valid and option path for people to work through. But it's not what we're talking about here. It's not about opposing aggressive therapy. Sometimes it's right, sometimes it may not be right. But also, it's not about treatment that might shorten somebody's life that you're giving for a different reason. So giving high painkillers, very high dose pain relief, might shorten a person's life. But that's not why you're doing it. You're giving pain relief in order to keep pain at bay. That's the motivation. There's a thing called double effect. If you keep the pain at bay, you might shorten the patient's life, but that's not the intention. So that's not what we're talking about. We are talking about the deliberate and proactive intervention to take someone's life, someone who is terminally ill, may not be able to do it for themselves and is asking for it. Now, this is not simple. It's a very complex area, a very emotive area. It's difficult and it's personal. Many of us have stories of relatives, others that, or some of us may indeed face it ourselves. How do we work this through? And there are voices out there like the voice of Terry Pratchett, Stephen Hawking's, Bruce Forsyth, would you believe it, saying we should be looking at assisted suicide. How do we work this through? In working any ethical issue through, there are four guide processes that Christians look to. We look to the Bible. What does the Bible say? We look to being led by the Holy Spirit. We look to church, the church, tradition, authority. How have Christians thought this through in the past? And we look to reason, thinking things through. So if we start with the Bible on this whole issue of assisted suicide, we see that with the image of God, that we are made in the image of God, is incredibly important here. That we're not just dealing with evolved primate apes. We're dealing with people whom God has said, they bear my image. There is something different about us. Now, it's easy also to turn to the thing that says, thou shalt not kill. Well, actually, that's not so simple. Because it doesn't say thou shalt not kill. It says thou shalt not manslay. Kill inappropriately. Which is harsh, because then you've got to decide actually what is appropriate killing and what's not. Because if it said thou shalt not kill, you actually couldn't fight in any war. So where do we go with that? Thou shalt not kill inappropriately. We actually have to work this one through. And the Bible gives us values of love and grace, compassion and hospitality, service, joy, peace, kindness, goodness, self-control. And so we work from the Bible and we work with the Holy Spirit as He leads us as we work through these issues. And we'll come to some of these issues. We also look to the church in the past and authority that has worked these things through. Actually, the church has always been against assisted suicide. I couldn't find one instance where it's been in favor of it through its entire history. But not only the church, actually most ethical traditions, almost all ethical traditions have been against it. The Hippocratic Oath says the doctor, which comes back well before time of Jesus, says the doctor will not provide poison even if the patient asks for it. So we're going back to a time where attitudes to death were very different, and yet when it came to physicians caring for patients, here's a line, we just will not cross it. assisted suicide is contrary to all historical codes of medical ethics, including the Hippocratic Oath, the Declaration of Geneva, the International Code of Medical Ethics, and a recent statement in Marbella. And there, that was 2013, which is the World Medical Association, that's 2013. And that says, physician-assisted suicide, like euthanasia, is unethical and must be condemned by the medical profession. Where the assistance of the physician is intentionally and deliberately directed at enabling an individual to end his or her own life, the physician acts unethically. Assisted suicide is opposed by the British Medical Association, the World Medical Association, the Association of Palliative Care, British Geriatric Society, and virtually every Royal Medical College, including the Royal College of GPs and the Royal College of Physicians. So looking to the church and looking to authorities that have worked this through, at the moment we don't see anyone saying assisted suicide has an ethical framework. There are still those who are pushing for it. Where do we go with that? We have reason. We are able to work things through. Now, how does medical ethics work things through? There are four elements to it. So we've had, we're working in bunches of four today. There are four things that work, that lead Christians, the Bible, the Holy Spirit, church, and authority and reason. Now we've got four things that medical ethics works through. Now, slightly big words, and we'll unpack these words. Please don't fall asleep as we hit them. First word is autonomy. The second word is beneficence. The third one is non-maleficence. Isn't that brilliant? It's just, if you're like me and you've just had a tooth taken out, it's really hard to say without spitting. Non-maleficence. And the third one, the last one is equity and justice. And this is a very useful framework to build on the foundation that we've already got, the foundation of looking to the Bible, the foundation of being led by the Holy Spirit. And here, I've gone from four to three, okay? We talk in our agency about 3D communication. That Christians are very good at one-dimensional communication, very good at talking to ourselves. But often, that language, the way we talk to ourselves and the language that we use and the basis upon which we're talking actually is only for ourselves. An outsider stands there and goes, I don't get it, and they're nuts. Okay, we need to develop 3D communicate. Why 3D? Why not just church it out others? Well, actually, we need to talk as Christians to Christians. We need to talk as Christians to a secular world out there, a secular world that is vaguely hostile, and they're not too sure why they're hostile to Christianity, but they know they are vaguely hostile to Christianity, and they don't like being told what to do by something that they're vaguely hostile to. So we've got to adapt our language. Just sort of going, thou shalt not, is not actually good language. The Bible says, is not useful in that interaction. It's part of where we've got there. We've got to be honest about that. But it's also not useful in that interaction. And the third one, the third dimension, is actually other faiths. It's not Christian and non-Christian. It's Christian, secular, without God, and then a Muslim community, a Hindu community, and other communities out there. So it's 3D communication. Right, that's the foundations to where we're going. Let's look at the first one, autonomy, choice. That I, to a large extent, am responsible for myself. Gone are the days when doctors could say, this is the best thing for you, do it. That was quite safe for some patients and quite safe for some doctors, but that's not where we're at. We need to take responsibility for ourselves. Autonomy is about taking responsibility and choice, but that choice is pushed to a long, That concept of choice is pushed a long way down the line now. My body, my choice. Don't tell me what to do. Is that biblical? Is choice for self presented by the Bible as godly? Well, actually, to a degree, yes, but maybe not to the degree that it's been pushed. I grew up hearing the concept of joy stood for Jesus first, others second, yourself last. It's best to put yourself last. Good old Protestant work ethics stuff. Actually, that's not what the Bible really says. Love your neighbor as yourself. If you don't love yourself, you really struggle to love your neighbor. That there is that balance. Yes, Jesus first, but also this balance. But it is not about me before any others, and the impact that my choice has on others doesn't matter. It does matter, and we'll come to that. I went to some of the parliamentary, the Conservative, Richard Graham, and with Sophie Gardner from the Labour Party. I didn't meet Jeremy Hamilton, but I met up with Sebastian Fulk. Not Fulk, Sebastian, what's his last name? Sebastian Fulk is the author. Thank you, Sebastian Fields. And I threw them a curveball in a public and said, assisted suicide is coming, the vote's coming, what do you feel about it, and how are you going to vote? And that's not an easy thing for them to answer on the spot, actually. And it was really interesting to see each one's thought pattern. I won't go into each one, except to say that one of them, and it was Sophie, came back with a very interesting thought pattern. She said, morally I'm not opposed to assisted suicide, and it might be something that I want for myself. But, and she's someone who's been in the RAF, she said, I've been around the world. What if my mum was to face that decision, and I didn't know who was there putting pressure on her? Would I want that for her? I think that was a really... That thought pattern illustrates what we're talking about here. Autonomy for self, yes, but it has ramifications that may bring that. Do we want to see that to trump other things? Another issue here is the role of dementia. Many of us know people whom dementia is slowly eating away at their cognitive, their ability to think, ability to reason. Often slowly you were eating away at who they are. Where's autonomy there? And how do we help in that situation? I think that my answer to that is maybe in 10, 20, 30, 40 years' time, we will have a process of arresting dementia or even reversing it. Maybe not reversing it, but stopping it, developing. And if 40 years from now we have a way of stopping it, but we've opened the gate to assisted suicide, we've caused real problems. Should the one issue of treatment for dementia, people with dementia now, cause problems to a generation beyond us? I think we really need to think that one through. The other issue here is we're talking about the issue of autonomy. Actually, assisted suicide is about those who have lost autonomy. They could go out and commit suicide. It's about people who have not got the autonomy to do it. So they're asking, it's asking others to help them in the name of autonomy. Whoa, that's a little bit, we're crossing lines here. So autonomy is important. It is complicated, but I don't believe it's a trump card. It's part of a balance. My right to choose, my body, my choice is not trumping stuff. So we get to the second one, beneficence, doing good. Now, some would argue that compassion. And when you're dealing with people who are in pain and they're coming to the end of their life and it's a horrible illness, would I treat my dog like that? Is a very common response. And yes, this is not simple. But others would argue that good hospice care means that we don't have to take the path of assisted suicide. Good hospice care, pain to a large extent, is controllable, not completely able to get on top of sometimes, often, but controllable, bearable. And with bearable comes the intention to add life. The hospice care, hospice says, not only can we help you die well, we will help you live before you die. It's not just about bearing. It's about living well in that last time. And actually having a full life, even right towards the end. And again, I think the issue of pain control is like that of dementia. Pain control is getting better and better. 20 years from now, should we open the door to assisted suicide and euthanasia, etc., etc., now, when 20 years from now, we may well have better pain control. So doing good, yes, there's compassion. But we need to remember that compassion is more than just for the person that I'm dealing with immediately, the ramifications that go beyond. And that actually compassion for good hospice care. Now, I've heard it argued and I've been in situations where people have said, yes, but we don't have the money for that. There are people out there who are really suffering because hospice care is too expensive for our elderly population. Then you're arguing finance. Let's let people die because we don't want to spend the money. That's about finance. It's not about compassion. Okay. Non-maleficence. That wonderful phrase. Non-maleficence. Do no harm. First, do no harm. Is assisted suicide? Who is assisted suicide potentially harming? If it's getting somebody out of a painful, traumatic end of life time. There is, of course, the people who are helping. What does that do to their soul, to their spirit? I'm very cautious about this one. To be involved in actively taking somebody's life. That's a big ask. Do we have the right to ask that of somebody else? Relationships. There is one relationship that I really want to look to us to address and think through. That's the doctor-patient relationship. That at the moment, doctor-patient relationships are supposed to be safe. It's something I work through. So I can go to my doctor and say, I might be suffering from depression, or I might have a terminal illness, and be working through the depressive side of that, and just say, I want to end it. I just wish it was over now. Please. And that's a safe environment to work. That expresses what I feel, but because the door is closed, it's safe. I can work through that. The instant that door is open, actually, you're staring at the abyss, and it's not a safe. It will change the nature of doctor-patient relationships. The other issue is, can we stop those that would want to harm? One of the stories I heard was from one of the other MPs was it's Richard Graham, in his flat in London, where he stays to go to Parliament. His landlady is 103. She plays a piano, she's compos mentis, she's fine, but he said the house that the flat is part of is well worth well into the millions. The pressure from family members and others who might want to get there. How do we stop? Are safeguards going to stop that potential. And if you look at definitely the safeguards that came from Lord Falconer last time, they are a chocolate fire guard. They're rubbish. They will not stop abuse. Now, in the future, there might be attempts to, yes, we recognize that this sort of abuse might happen. The real question comes is, actually, what would do more damage? The abuse, there are unethical people out there who would push. Is the damage that would do from that, when the door is open, to closing the door and there will be some patients who really struggle, which is the worst? The other thing, of course, is the right to die becomes the expectation to die. Do us all a favor. Do yourself a favor. Why go through this? I don't want to be a bother. And British people are really, really good at that. It's actually deeply ingrained in British psyche. I don't want to be a bother. And end of life stuff. You are a bother. Frankly, you will be. We will be. I will. I am now. That's okay. I live with it. But that pressure would be there. The right to die becomes the expectation to die. And the slippery slope is a real argument. People say, oh, you're just arguing the slippery slope. It's really there. If we look at abortion law, those who framed the abortion law had no intention of what happens now. Okay? Now, you could argue black and white, which is right. They did not have the intention when they made that law that now would be the case. So, if the door is open now, the slippery slope can very well happen. Okay, so we've gone from autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and we're looking at equity now. This is where we live in a society. Choice for me actually affects other people. Pressure on the elderly. The right to die becomes the expectation to die. The disabled and the handicapped. Gosh. How can you live like that? That must be so difficult. Wouldn't you just be better off not suffering? There's a really important court case just come in, which has gone through this week. It's not been in the papers, surprisingly, where a lady who she had Guillain-Barré syndrome, she could only blink with one eye, incredibly disabled, she's still not that well, has taken the CPS, the prosecution society, and said you're not prosecuting, the decision to not prosecute in some cases where people have assisted in suicide is changing the law. Now this is coming from a disability group, saying you can't change the law without Parliament thinking it through. And so the prosecution's prosecution service, has not been doing its job, and it's a disability group that is pushing this. Because part of that is they're going, what about us? We have a right to life. We have a right to not be expected to end ourselves. That we are precious. Getting back to this image of God, we are precious as we are. There are real fears. When we look at this issue, there are real fears. Fear of pain. I don't want to end my life in agony. There is very good, to a large extent controllable, not perfect, but often bearable. If you talk to people involved in hospice care, they say very rarely with really good hospice care do we get uncontrollable pain where people ask for to end it. With good hospice care, actually that's a rare thing. Other pain, other fears, we've got fear of pain, fear of loss of dignity. I'm lying there, I can't control going to the toilet. Well, good nursing care, it's part of it, but dignity, yeah. But is life Is that something that should open this door? Fear of dependence. We're so used to being I, me, dependent that we fear dependence. And yet sometimes that's something that God leads us into. Now is the time for my dependence to be part of the relationship with those that I'm in. Last one is, of course, the financial one. We can't afford it as a society. Well, we can afford what we choose to afford. You can imagine a slogan, help the NHS. Help those who have a future. The financial pressure. So yes, to dying well. This is a very complex area. This is about dying well and living well. Even right to the end. But I would suggest no to proactively taking life. Dying as well as possible. It may not be perfect. But is it worth opening this door? So what to do? Inform yourself. There's websites out there. There's Care Not Killing is an important one. Some of the disability groups. Get informed. Look at how the structure that we've looked at and become informed. It's going to come. Again, one of Richard Graham said, you know, I can get 1,000 letters about an issue that people feel strongly. Often it's under 100, but on issues where people feel strongly, I'll get 1,000 letters. But those 1,000 letters do not tell me what my constituents want. It just tells me what a certain type of my constituency want. Often they're handwritten letters. So yes, write our handwritten letters. Write emails. Write things to. But we need to, if this is important, we need to do far more. We need to go and see our MP in their surgery, armed with good arguments and stories. And knowledge. Speak knowledgeably. And not just one person, but lots of us. We need to engage in social media. Twitter, Facebook. We need to get into these websites where there is a lot of discussion about my body, my choice, religious nutters, etc., etc., and show that actually there is a real voice that speaks out, not just against the bill, but for dying well. It's not that we're against stuff, we're actually for dying well with God, knowing that death is not the end. We need to be ready for abuse. You get involved in this, you'll get abused. That's fine. We need to think ahead of time how to respond to abuse. And I would suggest it's best not to respond back with abuse. Sometimes the odd Winston Churchillism doesn't go too far wrong. But you don't want to respond in name calling, etc., etc. We need to learn how to respond with grace. Now, after church, after this is a big area. I mean, some people here might want to actually talk some questions through, or I'll stay here. And anyone who wants to just question, if you want to push back, fine, feel free to push back. If you want to say, actually, I'm not too sure about this. Where are we going? We can have a discussion going, because this is a beginning, not an end. See, this is the point of this of today. We've had 4 sessions leading up to voting on Thursday. The vote's not the end. The vote's the beginning. We need to be God's presence out there, working, changing society. Yes. Doing all that we do with clubs, etc., etc., but also being out there helping formulate policies, change, making sure that there is justice, working on all these other issues as well, but getting involved. And through all of this, we remember that God is God. He's the God of the resurrection. He's God of life. He's the defeater of death. Paul says, where, O death, is your sting? Yes, this is difficult. This is harsh. But we remember that this God holds this in his hand. And he is the God of life. He is indeed our great God.